is Iconic, with your hosts JM, Mark, and Nick.
Welcome to Iconic, where we talk about all things 13th Age. I'm your host, JM, and with me, as always, are Nick and Mark.
Hey.
Hello.
This week, we have a great show for you. In that iconic look, we're going to be looking at setting up your own icons for home games where you don't want to run in the Dragon Empire. In one unique thing, we have our first email, and we're going to be taking a second look at icon relationships and actually how to change them with new icons for your game. And in Class Acts, we're going to be taking our first look at a class in 13th Age, starting with the Barbarian. So let's head into that iconic look.
That iconic look.
Welcome to That Iconic Look. Today we're looking at creating your own icons. Icons are one unique thing about 13th Age. They're a very different take on how players interact with the world and the story. But if you don't want to run your game in the Dragon Empire, which is where the 13 icons are, or you want to create your own icons, how would you do that? What would you deal with? Nick, where would you start?
Well, I think first is just a good understanding of what it is the icons are, even in the Dragon Empire. On page 10 of the core rulebook, it says that icons work like the clans or factions in other role-playing games, and they give characters real grounding in the setting and help bring the setting to life. So just like the core rulebook says that about giving characters real grounding in the setting, I think that's a very accurate description and a good way of putting it. It's kind of an anchor point for the characters to latch onto and give them a little bit of structure, a little bit of direction, and for those times when they may be having a hard time figuring out, well, what is my character supposed to do in this situation, or what is the motivations of my character? It's those type of things that are present in the world that might answer those questions.
Okay. So when I was looking through the icons, I really felt like there were a number of different ways to kind of pick out the people who would be icons in your world. Mark, you want to start talking about some of those?
And then you look at the movers and shakers. If you're not going to run the Dragon Empire and you're running in, say, Forgotten Realms or Greyhawk or Middle Earth or whatever, you take the movers and shakers. You can use these names if you want, or come up with your own. I mean, Dwarf King is pretty stereotypical of fantasy settings. But you kind of pick who you want to be influential in your world. And I kind of like the icons more than, say, the old traditional D&D worlds where you had gods.
Mm-hmm.
Why would the gods be interested? These are more interested. The Emperor and the High Druid and people that are on the Earth and want certain things to happen. So you kind of pick out who you want, what are the motivations. I kind of like that they have this is 13th for 13th Age, but about 10, 12 icons I think are good, because if you only have a couple, then you really only have diametrically opposed
right.
people.
Yeah.
And having more of them, then you can be, okay, hey, we're allies now, but I might oppose you later.
Mm-hmm.
So that works, too.
Yeah, and along those lines, I would say, too, that when you're thinking about creating your own icons, make the icons have relationships with each other. Don't set up these movers and shakers in their own silos. You know, you want them to be able to interact with each other to give you a little bit of that motivation, so that if you're, you know, if you're aligned with the Dwarf King, you are going to be opposed to the Lich King or something like that.
Right. Well, I think Mark brought up a really good point. Rob and Jonathan did a great job creating icons that were iconic across the board of all fantasy genres. You can look in, I would say, pretty much any D&D campaign setting and be able to pick out at least 7 or 8 of these that correlate directly. So what are you looking for in icons in your world? I think that you need to make sure, as Nick said, that they have relationships to each other, but they also are aligned with a variety of moralities. I think saying, oh, this icon is only ever good. If you have too many of those, you fall into what Mark was talking about, where you have diametrically opposed factions. And then at that point, you don't really have the interplay for the narrative that you would like with the icons. So if you look at, like, in 13th Age, the Dwarf King can be good, or you can run him as ambiguous. Or I could think of a number of ways where the Dwarf King would be negative. But, you know, the Crusader, a lot of people think of him as a negative. Mark thinks of him as a force for good. Most of the rest of us would probably fall in the middle of that.
I'm currently running a paladin of the Crusader.
Yeah, and I don't think he's even ambiguous. I'm pretty sure your paladin is flat out evil.
No. He is there to save the world. If a few bystanders get trampled, a couple sessions ago we lost a few party members. And, you know, death salute from the Crusader.
I.e. the GM.
Well, in the 13th Age, paladins don't have to be good.
Right.
No.
So what are some other ways, what are some other areas you want to look for icons in your setting?
I think another way of looking at things is take the heads of nations, organizations, the leaders of the large forces in the world, and give them a title. And even if you have to boost their status a little bit to put them that one notch above just a king or just a ruler, go ahead and do that, because the more powerful they are, the more powerful an icon they're going to be for your players.
And it doesn't, just thinking about different game worlds, obviously Elminster jumps forward for Forgotten Realms, but you don't have to make your icons known. The Archmage, it's a figurehead.
Mm-hmm.
Who is the Archmage? Is it Mordekainen? Is it Elminster? I mean, you don't have to have this is the Archmage. It's maybe that shadowy figure. You don't know who it is, and he's pulling strings or he's, pushing an agenda, but you don't know who he is.
Well, that's one thing that I do with my Tanar setting. I have regional icons. So people who are playing in Northern Centauri, which is one of the main campaigns, I have a list of icons for them. Yet across the world, I have a completely different set of icons, because the world is so large and so dynamic that one of the icons are localized to a specific region. They're not going to be a worldwide force.
Are any of them worldwide?
Some of them are. Some of them show up.
Oh, do they have the same name on different continents?
They do not, except for the Lords of Death. In my world, everyone worships the Lords of Death with that title because they're afraid to draw attention by speaking to them individually.
He who must not be named.
He who must not be named. How'd you know Voldemort was my... No. The other thing you want to look at is people who are going to shake up or enforce the status quo. Agents of change are always great icons, because you're going to tie your players directly into opposing what's going on in the world. Likewise, in reinforcing the status quo just gives your players something big to back up against when the world pushes on them. So you want to look for similar presences in campaign worlds that you want to run. In fact, one of the things I love about icons, and talking about Forgotten Realms, one of the things I always wondered about Forgotten Realms is why do the realms need me? Like, why do the realms need my party? If you've got Dritz and the Companions of the Halls and Elminster and all of these guys running around, I'm just going to go hide in Neverwinter and let the world pass me by. But one of the things that icons let you do is you get to remove these power players from the campaign world, and you get to set them on a pedestal where they're still influential, but for whatever reason, they work through the players. It shines the spotlight from kind of the realm's icons, if you will, to the realm's players.
Or you're just a mook.
Or you're just a mook. The whole point of your character could just be to die to call out to have Elminster save him.
That's right.
That's right. You are Elminster's love interest, Mark. That is the extent of it. We thought we would give our listeners some advice on how to convert icons from some established fictional worlds. Mark's going to start off talking about Forgotten Realms. Nick is going to talk about some icons from the Malazan series by Steven Erickson. And I was going to talk about some homebrewed ones that I've created. Mark, who would you pick out as the icons of Forgotten Realms?
Well, there should be no surprise here. First one that came to mind when you asked me to look at this was Dritzed. He's very powerful. He could be the ranger in your world.
Yeah.
Another one related to that, the Spider Queen. It's already named for you. You don't even have to come up with another name, the Spider Queen. I know she's a god in Forgotten Realms, but you just make it an icon.
Yeah.
Another one, and it kind of shortened from the name, said the Red Wizards. It's the Red Wizard instead of the Archmage.
Oh, yeah, the guy who controls Thay.
Yeah. Okay. And I even thought one from Greyhawk, anybody knows that world. It was Begord, the thief, who started as a street urchin and becomes a god. But, could be the Prince of Shadows type.
Oh, man, I could list off half a dozen good Forgotten Realm or good Greyhawk
icons. Oh, yeah, icons. Yeah. There's just, think of any of the...
Uz.
Oh, yeah, Iuz. Yeah. Gratz.
Yeah.
Definitely, definitely.
Nick, as the newer of the to gaming of us, has a blank look in his eyes. I thought I would just share that with all of you.
Yeah, I feel like a halfling. Everything's over my head.
Oh, and thus the puns begin. We will be taking a contest to see if Nick stays on the show. So put in your votes on iconicpodcast.com. So Nick, Malazan series. For those of you who haven't read it, it is epic.
You should.
You should. It's epic military fantasy, high fantasy at its best.
I think my brain exploded about half a dozen times reading that. I kind of struggled thinking about which characters would be icons in that setting because there's so many powerful movers and shakers.
Try and keep this spoiler free because okay, Mark's only right. in book three.
I will keep it spoiler free.
I will tell you, my paladin's name is Kalam.
Ah, very nice.
Not that he's a thief or assassin, but he's a very ruthless killer. That's right. How I picture him. So,
well, if I got to be spoiler free, I don't know how much I can talk about these. I'll just name drop, and then if you want me to go into any of them, I'll let you. The three that I picked out were Anamander Rake, the Bridge Burners, and Itkovian.
All right, so give us as much of a – tell us who they are and why you picked them.
Anamander Rake, or all three of them. I don't want to spoil it for you.
No, you won't spoil it. Rake is – I've been introduced to Rake on what? Book
three.
And I know the Bridge Burners, maybe not all of them.
Well, all three of them, by the end of the series, have ascended.
Okay.
They're not quite gods, but they're not quite mortals any longer. So I felt like that was a really good balancing point between them, and all three of those had a really strong power in the story to rally people behind them.
Yes.
Even people who weren't of their race, you know, like Anamander Rake is Tist Andy, and there was a lot of humans and other Tist Eater and all that were following his call and heralded him as their hero, even though they were of a different race. So I felt like he would be a really good icon for people to rally behind.
Well, even the Bridge Burners as a military unit, people rallied other people in the Empire. That name carried weight. Just
exactly.
By being a Bridge Burner, you had
my weight. Question, though, is did they really rally behind Rake because they believed in him, or did they just fear that damn sword of his?
We'll be talking about that sword when we get to magic items, because that thing's fantastic.
I'll just say a little bit of both. and then as far as Itkovian goes, I mean, it's Itkovian. I mean, it's kind of
summation
of itself. Yeah. Definitely an emotional character, an emotional tie to that character. The one thing I just realized as I was going through these is all of these are kind of aligned good in a manner of speaking. I didn't pick out any that were, I mean, I suppose Rake might be ambiguous. And even Bridgeburner would be ambiguous. Itkovian would be solid, lawful.
Okay.
But.
Well, when I was approaching converting my homebrew game that I've been running for years to 13th Age, it was difficult to kind of come up with the icons at first, so I just started reskinning the 13th Age icons, giving them Tanar names. So... instead of the Dwarf King...
So you just add apostrophes.
Yeah, that's right. Instead of the Dwarf Kings, I have the Crystal Lords because the dwarves froze their gods. Their gods are imprisoned. Instead of the three, I've got a Draco Lich, Zenhir, who is a major mover and shaker in the world. He is definitely a negative icon. The Emperor became the Empress of the Cardane Empire. The Great Gold Worm translated into this mysterious force for good known as the Wanderer, who kind of moves around the world... nudging pieces in the right place. He's kind of a combination of the Archmage and the Great Gold Worm. But when I started the new game on the second continent, I went completely nuts in creating my own icons. I have a ship, the Lorgitha is the first ship the Sea Dwarves built, and it was such a perfect ship that it ascended to godhood. And so it is one of the icons, and it's a little strange. I have an Empress in Exile, the Elf Queen authorized... some magics that went horribly wrong and opened a portal to the abyss on the elf homelands. So she's ambiguous because she's willing to do whatever it takes to get her homelands back. Whether that means being good or evil, she doesn't care. She's got a goal in mind. One of the things I think about 13th Age that you need to keep in mind, like Mark said, just having the gods there is not necessarily enough. Because in most fantasy worlds, the gods are very far removed. If you're running a game where the gods are walking among mortals, more based off of, say, like Greek myth, where you could walk into Zeus. Zeus would be a good icon. Torm from the Forgotten Realms, not as good because, you know, he's pretty far removed. Any other thoughts on icons before we move on?
No, not really. I mean, I think if I was going to put this into my homebrew world, I would probably keep a lot of the names and the icons as they're made, you know. And that is an easy thing to do, just kind of take and, because they're not name specific,
right.
You know, a Tanar name or Forgotten Realms name. You can just call them by their title, and it works really great. So,
I would say that if you're looking for some examples of what some other people have done, there's a pretty long list on 13thAge.org of people who have made their own icons or made icons for their own worlds and submitted them there. And then at Parsantium.wordpress.com has some pretty fantastic examples of some homemade icons for the city of Parsantium. That's definitely more of an example of a regional or localized set of icons set in just one city rather than an entire world. But on both of those locations, some pretty good stuff there.
Fantastic. All right, well, let's head into One Unique Thing.
One Unique Thing.
Welcome to One Unique Thing, where we're actually going to talk about icon relationships a little bit more. We have our first emailer to the show, so I'd like to send a shout out to Jamie as a thank you for that. Jamie sent us an email, and we're going to read part of it and focus this One Unique Thing on answering his question. So, Mark, why don't you read Jamie's email?
Sure. How would you approach changing the rules if you don't want to use the stock setting / icons? The setting I'm working on has fairly radical reworkings of the 13 icons, but I took a deliberately conservative approach when changing their intent because there are some mechanics that seem to strongly favor the default setup over homebrewed settings, most notably the new Chaos Mage's iconic spells. Any advice?
Well, thank you, Jamie. There's a lot of ways to do that, and actually it's something I'm looking at with Tanar. There's really three ways that I see it, or that we see it, I should say. There's reskinning the icons, which is kind of the simplest, tweaking the powers, and designing new powers from the ground up.
In the core rulebook, there are two classes that do talk about icon relationships as a class feature. The first one that's mentioned are the bards, and there's a particular talent where basically if you rip on one icon, then you get a boon for its opposing mm-hmm. icon. And if you're wanting to adapt that to your own set of icons, I mean, that one right there it's a pretty simple one to do because there's nothing icon specific about it. It's just a generic, you rip up on one icon sort of deal.
Yeah, you just need the relationship chart so you know
exactly
who's the opposing icon that's going to start laughing at your jokes and give you a bonus.
And, of course, make your players sing.
That's right. Always make your players sing with a bard.
That's why I don't play a bard. The second one that's mentioned in the core rulebook that is very strongly tied with the icons is the sorcerer. Whenever you pick a sorcerer, you have the option of picking a heritage alignment with it. And depending on which icon you align your sorceress abilities with, you get certain bonuses or boosts to your actions, whether you're allowed to perform more breath spells or you get a plus to your defense or something like that. And I think that one, of the races that I've read so far, that one would take the most amount of work to figure out how it's going to work with your own setting. But really, I think if you're just going to reskin it, it would just look at what are the powers that your icons are bringing to the table, find a well-balanced boost to give it to them, something that maybe aligns with their power type a little bit. For instance, instead of being able to cast fire darts, maybe it's ice darts or something like that, depending on what the power is of your icon. And one option that came to mind is you just throw that class out. I mean, as I was looking at it, I was like, if I was going to do this for a setting of my own, this might be a lot of work. And the wizard class is right there next to it. And I know they're very different classes, and they each bring their own style and set of rules to the table. But if you don't want to put that much work into it, you don't have to include that.
Oh, no. That's definitely, I think, something for any game, to any new GMs out there. If you don't like a class or a rule, then don't run it. I know from the old D&D, I never ran monks.
Just
didn't fit into my idea of the world. Yeah, definitely. If you don't like the Chaos Mage, then don't run it.
Well, yeah, and speaking to the Chaos Mage, it is very heavily tied to the icons. Mm. One whole category of powers are all iconic-based. So the Archmage does this, and it gives you a daily and at will. So yeah, Nick kind of touched on it. Tweaking the powers is another way to do it. I'm a big fan of this. I'm a big fan of taking one power and just calling it something else, making a subtle change, and going from there. If you look at the Archmage power, Silverfire, for the Chaos Mage, just call it Flame Darts, and suddenly you have a Fire God icon or a Dwarf God icon. It could be Molten Metal. You can also change damage types as a simple way of flavoring new powers, like Nick said. You could turn Force to Fire or Fire to Ice, or Dwarven Rune Armor, as opposed to the Crusader power that the Chaos Mages have. Maybe it's runes that manifest, but does the exact same thing. This is very reactive game design, or setting design, if you will, both reskinning the icons, such as taking the same icons and calling them new names or tweaking powers. You only need to convert what the player picks. So like Nick said, throw it out if you don't like it, or don't worry about it. If no one's playing a sorcerer, just ignore it.
Unless you're like me and you just have to have everything figured out.
That's why we're introducing Nick to Pathfinder for him to run.
It's very simple. There's very few rules.
Yeah, there's not a whole lot of books. Yeah. You know,
and there's no...
Good to know.
Yeah.
Picked up the core rule book last week or a couple weeks ago and haven't had a chance to read it yet. It looks thicker than what you guys are describing.
Very few options.
Art. Yeah, most of that's art. So the proactive design, or the proactive way, is to completely design new powers from the ground up. And I'm going to turn this over to Mark because he's the expert GM here. Have you done this before for games? Have you designed new powers?
I wouldn't say I designed new powers so much as I have learned how to steal from other systems and rules and go, hey, that sounds pretty neat. Give it a new name, kind of balance, and that's – you just come – was kind of experience of – what level to set it, as far as, you know, the other game types, you know, what level, first level, second level spell, or in this case, the talent, is it an at will, is it a daily, is it a battle? Because you don't want it to overpower or be useless.
Right.
So if you're a GM out there, steal everything.
Yep.
Do you have any tips on balancing those out, or is it just
it's kind of hard.
Case by case.
Case by case, and sometimes I'll write down, hey, that's what I want to do, and I'll just make two fictional characters, you know, just kind of write some things down and say, okay, if this guy was fighting an ogre, cast the spell, and you do it a few times to see, because, you know, that nat 20 totally skews it. So you just try it a few times to see how it works, see if it's worth it. And a lot of it you just have to play with. And I've done it before where we've had a rule, and then after a few sessions before we started, hey guys, we need to change this because
make it more powerful.
It's either not powerful enough or, you know, your hose and stuff that shouldn't be. And then, you know, if roles go with the players, hey, let it go. That's great. Sometimes you win, sometimes they win. But there's sometimes you'll see things get skewed and it's too powerful for that first level mage to be.
Well, one thing that I really like about 13th Age is that it has a good benchmark system. Weapon damage for a level. If it does something more powerful than weapon dice equal to the level, give it some drawback. If it does less, start tacking on conditions or something else. Another good balancing trick is look at the other powers that either that class has or the other classes have. There are a couple of good sites online that you can go to look for new classes, new class powers. Vault of the 13th Age. And then, Jamie, if you're building your own powers for the icons, post them on the Google Plus community or send them to us and we'll post them on the Iconic website. And we'll get some feedback for you. 13th Age has a very active and very positive community. And if you put something up there, they're going to help you figure it out. There's a lot of brain power out there. Tap it and use it.
And let the rest of us steal it.
That's right. That's right. My wife is a crafter. She makes cards, and her motto is to case it, copy and steal everything. So that is those are words to live by as a GM.
Well, on the topic of community contributions, if you want a great chart on how to manage icon relationships in your game, which of your players are aligned with which icons and in what way, check out Kazakami's icon relationship chart from Pellegrin Press website. We will put the link to that in our show notes, but check it out. It's pretty cool.
Yeah, it's the chart I use at the table when I remember it, which is only about half the time.
And they do provide a form fillable option so that you can do all of your edits right there on the computer on the fly or on your iPad or whatever.
The only downside to that is when you kill a bunch of players off, then you got to print out a new one, as I found out. All right, let's hit into Class X.
He's really not that sorry about it.
We have a new segment on the show that we're introducing called Class Act, where we talk about the classes in 13th Age, looking at one of them each segment. And this time we're talking about the Barbarian, and Mark's got a quote for us.
Crush your enemies, see them driven before you, and hear the lamentations of their women.
Brought to you by Conan the Barbarian.
And if you look right at the first page of the class description, tell me that's not Conan leaping into the fray.
Oh, that's totally Conan. The reason we're starting with the Barbarian is because
it... Alphabetical?
It was alphabetical, but it's also because it is the simplest class out of all of them.
That's their terms.
Well,
I have a bone to pick about the simplest, but...
Well, it is definitely the least complex class out of all of them from a mechanic perspective.
I would even say there's less choice during the game session when you're picking what to do. The wizard has 20 power cards laid out.
I think that's where they're looking at this one.
I just don't want people to get skewed when they say, oh, it's the simplest one. None of them are that simple. You really have a lot of choices to make, and choices you make early will affect you later as you get your talents and feats and everything else and what you do. And the other thing I think you really need to look at is when you decide what to play, and it doesn't matter what game system it is, when you go into it is, what kind of character do I want to play?
Mm-hmm.
I rarely have the urge to play a wizard. They're great classes. I just don't get into them that much as part of playing them. Now, as a GM, I throw the uber-powerful wizard because it's nothing like taking him down from the player standpoint. So it's not always the simplest, you know. You've got to...
Yeah, I was going to say simple mechanics, but that doesn't necessarily mean simple character.
Right.
Yes, yes. That's right. It's when people, if they're hearing it for the first time, never open the book, it's not, you know...
It's really more of a difference of there's 4 pages on the Barbarian and like 12 pages on the wizard.
Exactly.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
If you have a new player or even an old player who wants to run in there with a big weapon and do a lot of damage, the Barbarian is for you.
Yes. It is the toughest or one of the tough classes. It is doesn't give you a whole lot of choices. You make your choices during character creation. And then, you know, as Kyle says, his choices figure out who's staggered and go for it.
Yes. He's our player, and he played a sorcerer who died and played him well. But he's like, next time, I want to carry a big axe and beat down some things.
So, Mark, why don't you tell us about some of the choices? How do you build a Barbarian?
Well, there's not a lot of choices. As I said, there's simplicity in it. You have to pick kind of how you picture your Barbarian. You've got your every Barbarian has Barbarian Rage. We'll talk about that in a little bit. And you've got to kind of think about how you want to build your Barbarian. They do deal a lot of damage. That is the type of character they are.
One of the things that you do when you look at classes in 13th Age, you've got class features, you've got talents, and you've got powers. Barbarians don't have powers. They have one class feature. And you're going to start with 3 talents, and you're going to end with 5. You're not going to be inundated with a bunch of choices. When do I use this power? The power you have to worry about is rage, and that affects everything else, and everything else just kind of stacks on your basic to hit roll for the most part. The one feature they do have is Barbarian Rage. Nick, you want to tell us how that works?
Yeah, in its simplest form, your character goes berserk and starts lashing out very violently against all foes in sight. Mechanically, whenever you're playing that character, instead of rolling 1d20 to hit, you roll 2d20. So you have a much better chances of success than you would just rolling 1. And then you also have a bonus that if you roll an 11 plus on both dice and one of them hit, and at least one of them hits, that attack counts as a crit. So you may roll a 16 and a 12, and it's synonymous with rolling a natural 20. So you're going to be doing a lot of damage pretty quickly, and it seems to be stacked very much in your favor. There is a recharge, though, because that's a once-per-day feature, that after the battle is done, if you recharge it with by rolling a 1d20, and if you get a 16 or higher, then you can use that again later in the day. If you don't roll 16 or higher, then you must wait until the next day.
Or if you take that adventurer feat, and this is what our barbarian did, and you just wait for the escalation die to reach 4, now you can rage for free. But you have to wait.
Right.
So, Mark, what is best in barbarian? What is best in life?
I like what is best in life. It was interesting if you ever look at that quote, you know, in the movie, and if you're in Robert E. Howard and the whole Conan thing, and that quote comes from Genghis Khan and the Mongols, and they had nothing to do, but it's one of those, you know, how things touch in the world. I like, one of the things I like with the barbarian is building frenzy.
Okay, what does that one mean?
It's basically your barbarian's getting frustrated because he's missing. And so, if he misses...
So like your paladin.
Oh, we're going there. So building frenzy, one battle per day as a free action. You have missed with an attack. You deal plus 1d4 on your miss, and you deal additional 1d4 damage each time you miss. So it keeps building because you're getting pissed because you're missing and missing and missing. And then there's you know, adventurer champion feats, and the die increases from d4s to d6s and just d10s. You're doing more damage when you're missing because you're just ticked because you're missing, which would be nice on certain nights when you can't hit.
So what you're saying is kill Kyle's character before he gets that far.
Basically, they do damage. I mean, everybody does miss damage, but they just do more miss damage
because
they're not happy that they missed.
So potentially by the end of the battle, you may be hoping you miss because you're going to be doing 4d10 worth of damage.
Yeah, kind of. I mean, you can put it that way. They do more damage if they hit. And again, when we talk about their simple in mechanics, our barbarian's very smart. They do bounce around the field, and he tries to pay attention.
As
I play a paladin, I smite somebody. Hey, JM says, hey, he's staggered. That's the next person that Kyle attacks because he knows he gets bonuses with his talent of Slayer if they're staggered. I think it's Slayer.
Yeah, that's actually the talent that I would pick. As I looked at what the talents are available, if I was going to play a barbarian, that's probably one of the first ones I would pick. It definitely adds an element of paying attention to what's going on in combat. So you know who is staggered, who's not. You do a lot more moving around in combat, jumping from, you know, NPC to NPC, slaying all the monsters, rather than just hunkering down and bashing it out just one-on-one. And then with the 13th Age mechanic of intercepting, is it called intercepting?
Yeah, it's called intercepting.
With the 13th Age mechanic of intercepting, I think that would tie in really well with the Slayer feature, or the Slayer talent, I should say.
Well, mine is Ancestral Warband. I'm jumping all the way up to Epic Talents. You summon the spirits of your ancestors to fight alongside you. Every turn you roll a d6, and if you roll equal to or less than the escalation die, you get to make another attack as your warband makes an attack. And if you take the epic level feat, they are always considered raging, even if you are not. So they get the 2d20 bonus.
Mm.
If you're knocked unconscious.
Yes.
Yes, they fight for a single round while you are unconscious.
And there's a lot of things to think of when you're designing your barbarian. Also include races, because I know Jam loves wood elf barbarians. Because they get the roll under escalation die and get that extra action.
Oh, man. I love wood elf barbarians compared to wood elf rangers. Woof.
Oh.
See, I would go really outside the box and play a halfling barbarian, because I think that would just be comical and a lot of fun.
Dark side one. Actually, that leads into our last little bit here. We wanted to talk about what we would do individually if we were to play the barbarian. So, Nick, what did you pick? If you were to make a barbarian right now, what would your race, background, and one unique thing be?
Well, like I mentioned, I would go with halfling as the race. The background, I would say that my character is a direct descendant of the first halflings. The book kind of makes a call out. No one knows where they came from, but my character does. He's not going to tell anyone, but he knows.
Okay.
And my one unique thing was that I was born with a dragon scale covering my heart.
Would you name him Bumble Durkin?
No.
If you don't know Bumble Durkin, Google it.
Google Bumble Durkins and go to dungeonbastard.com. So, Mark, what would you be playing as a barbarian?
Half-orcs. For some reason, I've been into them lately. It's a good fit.
Oh, yeah.
Kind of iconic, as it were. I thought maybe Bear Clan or Gladiator, maybe Honey Badger Clan. I don't know. pick it. One unique thing, I couldn't decide on something. That's something I struggle with coming up, something very unique. Maybe if I'm a Bear Clan warrior and I'm their champion, my one unique thing is I like honey. I don't know.
Oh, hey, you know what? They don't have to be.
Is your name Winnie?
Yes.
Well, I'll round us out here with a very simple human barbarian. I always love playing barbarians as kind of the noble savage, and that's what I would do. My backgrounds would be something like Child of the King, Chosen of the Wolf Spirit, and I think for my one unique thing, I would definitely have to go with Destined to Wear the Crown of Man. Let the GM do whatever he wanted with that, but I think I can get some mileage out of that one.
I seem to recall another barbarian that became a king.
Yeah, multiple.
Karsa.
And Conan.
Conan, Gull.
Oh, yeah. It is a trope.
It is,
and
yeah.
It is
yeah,
a trope. Yeah. Well, you've been listening to the Iconic Podcast.
If you have any questions or comments, you can contact us at whitedragon@iconicpodcast.com or call and leave a voicemail at 720-924-1706.
And check out iconicpodcast.com for news, updates, and new episodes.
Thanks for listening.